Well, hey, folks, welcome to the Funky Biscuit. Happy Saturday night to you. Nice to have you guys here. One more time for Richie Schmidt opening up the show for us. Appreciate it very much.
Good to see so many people here tonight.
Appreciate you guys being here and supporting live music. First time at the Funky Biscuit. This is a storyteller series. Give it up for Rick Derringer. An All-American boy.
Gather around, cats, and I'll tell you a story about how to become an All-American boy. You buy your guitar and put it in tune. You'll be rocking and rolling soon. Impressing the girls, taking hot licks, and all that jazz. Well, I got my guitar about a year ago. Learned how to play it in a day or so. Went all around town, it was well understood that I was knocking them dead like Johnny B. Good. Impressing the girls, showing off. Yeah, I was number one. I was rocking and popping and getting the breaks. The girls all said that I had what it takes. When up stepped a man with a big cigar. He said, come here, kid, I'm gonna make you a star. I'll put you on a bandstand, buy you a Cadillac. Sign here, kid. Well, I signed my name and I became a star. Having a ball with my guitar. Driving that big long Cadillac. Fighting the girls off my back. But they just coming. They were screaming. Yeah, they like me. Good evening, everybody. Yeah, that's my story. That's how I became the All-American boy. My first guitar I got in 1956, which some people call the year of Elvis. And then I had my first hit in 1965, which some people call the year of the Beatles. So what that means is, it's been hardwired into my psyche to be, into my DNA, to be a rocker. So here I am tonight telling my story. It's kind of like that song just said, up stepped a man with a big cigar. Except in my case, it was three men with big cigars. And they called themselves the Strangeloves. My band, the McCoys, backed the Strangeloves one night. And it turns out the Strangeloves, who portrayed three Australian sheep herders, were actually, they weren't really Miles, Niles, and Giles Strange, which is what they called themselves. They were actually FGG Productions, three good producers from New York City. And on that trip where we opened for them in Dayton, Ohio, they happened to be looking for a band that looked like the Beatles. They said there was a number one song on the R&B charts. It was called My Girl Sloopy. And in those days, what they tried to do is they tried to take a black song and find a white group to do it, and then they'd sell even more numbers when the white group did it. So since that was the year of the Beatles, these guys said, wow, if we can find a group of young guys looks kind of like the Beatles, and we do that song, My Girl Sloopy, I'll bet you that thing would be a great big hit. So, they asked us, after playing that first show with them, they said, would you come back to New York City tomorrow and record Hang On Sloopy? I mean, it's couldn't make up a story like this. So, I looked at my dad, who was standing in the dressing room, and because we were young kids. I said, well, Dad, what do you think? New York City. He said, well, son, my vacation starts tomorrow. So we were actually able to get in our car, pull our little trailer, follow these guys back to New York City, and within 3 days we had recorded Hang On Sloopy. It went ahead to become number one in every country of the world that sells records. It's so number one, it's the only rock and roll song in the history of the world that's ever been voted an official state rock and roll anthem. One state in the union had the nerve to vote in a state rock and roll anthem. I'll bet some of you know which state. Ohio. You got it. It was the fight song for the Ohio State Marching Band, and then it went ahead to become voted officially the state rock and roll anthem of Ohio. Recently, they were filming a movie called Hang On Sloopy, the movie, and we were able to go to Ohio, and they pulled a little bandstand out in front of the whole marching band, and in front of 100,000 people, we got to play Hang On Sloopy with the marching band. If you can imagine that. It's pretty amazing. Maybe if we're all lucky, we'll get to see that movie pretty soon. Hang On Sloopy, the movie. But since you guys are here tonight, we're here to play these old songs. So Ken, let's take them all the way back to the 60s. This song, they went and they edited out the second verse. So what that means is every single time you guys have heard this song throughout your whole life, you've been cheated out of the second verse.
Hey!
So I come here tonight to right a long-standing injustice.
Yeah!
I'm here tonight to set the record straight once and for all. And you know why?
Because the buck stops right here, baby. So tonight, we're going to play for you that missing second verse.
Sloopy wears a red dress, yeah. It's as old as the hills.
But when Sloopy wears that red dress, Lord,
you know it gives me the chills. Yeah, yeah. Well, Sloopy, when I see you walking down that street,
I say, you know, Sloopy girl,
you're the one for me.
So I say now, hang on, Sloopy, Sloopy, hang on. Yeah, I heard a couple of you singing it that night.
Let it hang down on me. Yeah, yeah. Come on, sleep. come on, Susie, one more. Well, make me feel so good.
Come on, come on.
Well, make me feel so good.
Come on, come on.
Well, shake it, shake it, shake it, Susie.
Come on, come on.
Shake it, shake it, shake it, Susie.
Come on, come on.
Tonight, this is an interesting one. The song was so big, the song was so huge and such a success, the producers said, well, we can't screw this up. We cannot screw this up with this. The second song has to be just as successful as the first one. So here's what they did. The second single by the McCoys sounded like this.
Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
You give me fever.
When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever.
Fever.
In the morning, fever all through the night. This was the third single.
And those were the first three singles. Now, we had come from the reason they liked us when they saw us in the first place, we were, even though we were kids, we were a pretty seasoned band. We liked playing blues. We liked playing soul music. We liked playing the hits of the day. But we certainly didn't consider ourselves kind of newcomers, amateurs. We'd been doing it a long time, and we thought we were pretty cool. Well, all of a sudden, after doing Hang on Sloopy Fever and Come On, Let's Go, a whole new genre of music was moving in. There were bands like the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. People like that, having hits of the day. But they were considered not very, really very good players. They weren't considered really good bands. In fact, they came up with a whole name for that genre. They called it bubblegum music. Bubblegum music, pop music, but they called it bubblegum music. Now, the McCoys, all of a sudden, were lumped into this bag of bubblegum music people, and we didn't like it. We said, you know, we're not bubblegum music. We're a pretty cool little band. We don't want to be bubblegum music. So they were offering us songs like we were offered Come On Down to My Boat, Baby, for instance, which turned out to be a great big huge hit. But we turned it down just because we said we can't keep doing these inane songs and be lumped into this bubblegum group thing. So what we did was we quit the record company. We did everything you're not supposed to do. We got out of our contract with the people that just had three big hits with us. We got out of our contract. We went with the record company, Mercury Records, who said, well, you can do whatever you want. You can do any kind of music you want. We got a job. We lived in New York City, and we got a job. We found a gig at the hippest club in New York City. It was called Steve Falls, The Scene. And we got a gig there, the McCoys, and they called us the house band. So we were doing everything we could do to break out of that kind of bubblegum genre. We met at the Scene in New York City. I met Jimi Hendrix many times, played with him a whole bunch down there. Had my guitar stolen from right out of the dressing room one night, and Jimmy loaned me his. He said, you're going to have to string one of those guitars upside down because I don't play it the same direction you do. But he said, you're certainly welcome to use my guitars. So I felt really good that we had gotten to meet Jimmy. But we were on this grand exercise to try to break out of that bubblegum image. So one of the songs we played at the Scene, I'm going to play for you right now. This is one that the McCoys used to play at the Scene. I know my life. Daybreak.
Wow.
Yeah, we thought, you know, if that kind of music doesn't scare a lot of McCoy's fans, nothing else will. But nonetheless, we were playing that stuff down at the Scene, jamming with Jimi Hendrix and the like. The owner of the Scene adopted us. He became our manager, Steve Paul. And one night he brought down there to the Scene Johnny and Edgar Winter. Yeah. Yeah. He had this idea, this kooky idea, that these guys, the McCoys, would be a great backup band for Johnny Winter. Now, Johnny Winter, not hearing us yet, the McCoys? You gotta be kidding me. So that's why he brought Edgar. He said, Edgar, you're gonna come with me, and you're gonna help me make my mind up, because I don't know about this McCoys idea. This sounds kooky. But Edgar, I'll bring you along. You let me know what you think of the guys. And so we played. We played the show, including songs like Daybreak. We played a lot of other stuff in those days. We were a pretty cool band. But the bottom line was, when it was set was over, Johnny said to Edgar, well, what do you think, Edgar? Would these guys, could this work? To my surprise, Edgar Winter told Johnny Winter, yeah, man, this is going to be cool. So that opened the door to our way out of the whole bubblegum thing. Johnny Winter, all of a sudden, he had credentials out the wazoo, you might say. And if Rick Derringer and the McCoys were going to break out of any bubblegum image, it was going to be as Johnny Winter's band. We called ourselves Johnny Winter and... We did a lot of shows live. We did a couple good albums, too. Johnny checked himself into a hospital for his drug issues. He was had ongoing drug issues. So he checked himself into a hospital. And when he got out, I wrote a song for him, for Johnny Winter, that we'll play for you right now. Thank you.
the line they found. Jesus Christ is risen up to heaven from the grave. He's still alive and well. Yeah, yeah, still alive and well. Still alive and well. Jesus is the answer come to set people free. He's still alive and well.
And well, wow. And so then played with Johnny for a few years out there on the road. And when he checked himself into that hospital for his drug issues, I had just produced an album for his brother, for Edgar Winter. And it was called Edgar Winter's White Trash. And I realized during the making of that record, he wasn't really totally happy with his guitarist that he had in the band at that time. I thought the guy was pretty cool, but I know Edgar wasn't totally satisfied. So all of a sudden, seeing that Johnny was in the hospital, I was kind of at liberty. And so I called up Edgar and I said, Edgar, are you still dissatisfied with that guitar player of yours? And he said, yeah, I'm not happy yet. I said, well, how about if I join your band and we become Rick and Edgar together with White Trash? He said, that's a great idea. So I proceeded to join Edgar Winter. I played with him in the White Trash for quite a while. We did one of my favorite albums that I ever worked on, that I ever recorded. It's called A Road Work. Love Roadwork. What a band that was. That's one of the best bands I ever played with. They were a really fabulous band. But while we were in the studio doing the next album, we recorded a song that Edgar Winter had always called the Double Drum Solo. And it was specifically a song where he could just show off. He could play keyboards, he could play saxophone, he could jump up on the drums, he could play timbales, he could play all this stuff, but he always called it the double drum solo. So we went into the studio, we recorded the song. It was way too long. The record company said, well, that's really all well and good, but we don't think it doesn't fit on this record. And I don't know if it's right for this record. And we told them, well, you kidding? This song is really cool. I mean, everybody's going to love this song when they hear it. So what we did was, since it was too long, in those days we were recording on 2-inch tape. So in order to edit a song, you had to physically take the tape with a razor blade and just slice that tape where you thought the edit should be. Take another piece where the next edit spot would be, slice that tape, and then take the two pieces of the tape, put them together with a big piece of white tape over that slice. Well, we edited every section in that song multiple times so that when we watched it play, it got to the point where all we could really see was white tape, white tape, white tape, white tape. It just kept playing white tape, white tape, white tape. I said, this thing's got so much tape on it, it should be called Frankenstein. I might have said the Frankenstein monster, and Edgar might have said, well, that's not a bad idea, but maybe it should just be Frankenstein. So we did. We recorded it, and the labels, once again, were full of crap. Because it not only should be on the record, it turned out to be Edgar's biggest hit, I think. biggest hit he ever did. So, in a most unconventional way, on this acoustic, this quiet little acoustic guitar, we're going to play for you guys. In a laboratory, once upon a time, at work was a doctor named Frankenstein. Tell everybody you heard Frankenstein on an acoustic guitar. I know I haven't, Edgar hasn't heard me do that. Then while I was in White Trash, a kid from Pennsylvania started sending tapes. He would send a tape every week to our office. And most weeks we would just push that thing aside. Wouldn't really listen to it. There's that tape again. There's that guy sending the tape again. We got a tape. So finally, one day I said, we better listen. This guy's, if nothing else, he's punctual. He said, we got that tape coming every week. So I opened the tape one day. I pulled it out. And the very first song on the tape was Free Ride. I think then the second song was the one our opening act here played tonight called Altamira. I think that was the second song on the tape. But at any rate, the guy's name was Dan Hartman. And Dan Hartman joined the band. He became a part of the Edgar Winter group. He went ahead after the Edgar Winter group and did all those big disco songs. Instant Replay. Fabulous record. He became, he produced James Brown, that's right, wrote one of James Brown's biggest songs.
Living in America.
That's Living in America. He became, I don't want to say, one of his better partners became Freddie Mercury. Freddie Mercury and him, they had kind of a little affair. Well, I think we can say that in this day and age. Freddie Mercury and Dan. Dan turned out to be a real superstar in his own right. So we're going to play one of his songs right now.
Yeah.
Dan Hartman.
Danny!
Okay, let's move on a little bit here. I was living in New York City, and somebody called me up, and they said, there's a group called Blue Angel. Blue Angel. They were called Blue Angel. They said, this group is a good group. We love this group. But they're losing their record deal. Rick, would you help them? Would you produce a demo for them to hopefully help them get their record deal back? So I said, sure, why not? It sounds cool. So I went over and heard the band, and they were very good. I did the demo for them, sent it back over to the record company. Record company said, you know what? We like the singer. We think the singer, we're forget about that band. We think this singer could be really cool. So they went ahead and signed her. She was Cyndi Lauper. So over the years, I've had the opportunity to help a lot of artists, Johnny and Edgar, Cyndi. And the bottom line is, Cyndi turned me on to a lot of other people. She was the one that introduced me to Vince McMahon, who is the leader of the World Wrestling Federation. I think now it's the WWE. And I helped produce their first two records. The first one was called just the Wrestling Album, and the second one was called Pile Driver. But I got to know all the wrestlers through that experience and stuff. Cyndi sang with me. In fact, she asked me to go out on tour with her. I joined her for about a year all around the world, playing with Cyndi. That was a totally unusual experience. Cindy's quite a girl. She can have a temper tantrum now and then. We all found out. But she's fabulous. What a great, great entertainer she was. And like I said, she introduced me to all the people over at the World Wrestling Federation. And we recorded two albums. The first one included a song that I thought, man, I have just written the most patriotic song of all time. And that's the way I envisioned it. I said, this song has legs. This song is patriotic. I never, ever thought that they would want to do it on the wrestling album and that Hulk Hogan would adopt it as his theme song. So to this day, he still uses it. But in some ways, I was just so let down. I felt like, man, I wrote this fabulous patriotic song for all Americans, and here it is, a wrestler's theme song. I couldn't believe it. So later on, and as the song was used again and again and again, Hillary Clinton used it when she ran against Barack Obama the first time. And I said, wow, somebody in the political world has agreed with me that this is a really patriotic song. Well, she didn't win. So then Newt Gingrich used it when he won his primary. And I went, wow, other politicians are finding it. Now we've got politicians on both sides of the aisle that like it. Never did I expect that when the whole controversy about Barack Obama's birth certificate would come around, that he would decide to make a video with his birth certificate on the screen, bouncing in and out of the screen, to the music of I Am a Real American. That's gotten 12 to 13 million hits on YouTube at this point. You can still pull that up. Correspondence Dinner, Real American, and you'll see him gloating in front of that big birth certificate. Then, so since he used it, now recently, I mean just within the past couple weeks, guess who walked out to Real American? Donald Trump. So, I understand, I read this recently in the last week, that when Donald Trump and Barack were hanging out together, Barack razzed Donald Trump and said, "Hey, what are you using my song now?" I'm going, wow. And they even mentioned my name in the article, Rick Derringer's Real American. So I guess really it has become what I always envisioned it, the possible next national anthem of the United States. So we really feel like that we've got all these precious Americans fighting for us every day, 6-7 days a week, 365 days a year. They put their lives on the line to make it possible for all of us to be here tonight and hanging out and drinking and having a good time. So those men and women, those Americans, really are the ones that deserve our heartfelt thanks. So I'm going to play a couple songs right now on this acoustic guitar to say thank you to those men and women in uniform. And thank you to Donald Trump, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Newt Gingrich.
Everybody did something.
Yeah.
Fight for the rights of every man.
Another thing that happened, I was the first person that they that had the opportunity to use a wireless guitar without a cable. My band, when I had the band called Derringer, a guy in New York, Ken Schaefer was his name, he invented the first wireless guitar transmitter. So we were the first people on stage to be using wireless guitars at that time. So we thought, wouldn't it be cool? Because you got to have some way to show off that it's wireless, that there's no wires. So me and the other guitar player said, wouldn't it be cool if at some point in the show, while we're playing, we both go one, two, three, and just toss. I'll toss my guitar to you, and you toss yours to me, simultaneously. We said, that'll really be cool. Yeah, we did that quite a few times. We only broke a couple guitars. But we did break a couple guitars doing it. Knocked the neck right off one day. Knocked the neck right off the guitar. But that was just one of our things. Then I had the opportunity to record my first solo album, which was called All American Boy. And people always say, you know, they one of the things they don't talk about too much, but they want to know, they kind of in the back of their head, they want to know, what about groupies? What was that groupie thing all about? Well, I can tell you that it was fabulous.
Hello.
It was quite a earth-shaking development that came into the world of rock and roll. Groupies. So, I decided to write a song, and on All American Boy, I recorded a song that's really my homage to both groupies and to life on the road. And it's called The Airport Giveth, The Airport Taketh Away.
Take it away.
the same old show. He says he'll come back. The airport giver, the airport taken away. The airport giver, the airport taken away. The airport giver, the airport taken away. You guys have been a fabulous audience tonight. I think I'd like to introduce you to the boys in my band. I got a good band here. I thank you once again for putting up with my struggles. I haven't played on an acoustic guitar in front of a microphone for so long. I have to learn how to get this thing under control so it don't feed back and so I can turn it up a little bit. But you guys have been very forgiving. And you've heard a lot of stories that you may not have expected to hear, so we appreciate your patience in that respect, and you've been fabulous. So I want to introduce you. I'll start with my bass player over here. He's been playing with me a long time. I say 30 years, but it's been longer than that. It's been longer than that. If you didn't see him on the road playing with me, you might have seen him out on the road playing with people like Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis. Bo Diddley, Flavor Flav, yeah, Edgar Winter, Buddy Miles. This guy gets around.
I did jam with Leon Russell once.
Leon Russell.
God bless his soul.
God bless Leon Russell's soul. Tonight, as a matter of fact, that's right. So at any rate, the bottom line is this guy's one of the best entertainers you'll ever see and one of the best bass players you'll ever hear. Let's hear it for our bass guitar player, Mr. Charlie Torres. Charlie Torres. Now back behind me here on the drums, he's the newest member of the band, but that's been like 5 years. So now. Probably 5 years. And he also has an illustrious background. He played with Deodato. They still occasionally do a thing together. You never know when. Also, he was the drummer for Buddy Miles.
And our keyboard player is here.
You know, and if Buddy Miles was going to choose a drummer, you know that drummer was going to be pretty good. So, I'm very happy to... to introduce you to that drummer. Here he is, Mr. Ken Mutino on the drums.
Can we turn? Okay, I get into the monitor. How you feeling so far? We are here with a living legend. We're hearing the stories no one's ever told or heard. He's played with the likes of Todd Rundgren, Barbara Streisand, Air Supply, Alice Cooper, Steely Dan, Kiss, Lick It Up. That's right. The list goes on and on. Let's see, Chick Corea is on his album. Joe Walsh is on his albums. David Bromberg. He started Weird Al Yankovic. It's the whole rainbow of music.
I produced Weird Al's first six albums.
Thank you. Eat it. Not you, I'm talking about the song. And
I won two Grammys for Weird Al.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, Charlie here, since we're telling the story, Charlie here and I worked together for 20 years. For 40 years, I tried to meet Rick Derringer. Finally, I got to book Rick Derringer, and now, thanks to God, I'm in the band. I am thankful. I got my childhood friends here, over here. I was playing air guitar on the top of cars to sitting by the pool back in the 70s. And now I am here and I am so thankful to be here in Boca Raton for our first Storytellers concert. So ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we'd like you to give a Boca heartfelt welcome for the living legend, Mr. Rick Derringer!
Couldn't stop moving when it first took hold. On the spring night at the old town hall, was a group called the Jokers. They were laying it down. No, we're never gonna lose that funky sound. Rock and roll, hold you cool. Naughty mama, light the fuse. Go down and spread the news. Yeah. Skeeter started buzzing about this time of year. Going around back, said they'd meet me there. We were rolling in the grass just behind the barn. My ears started ringing like a fire alarm. Woo-hoo! claim is true.
Signing some autographs and some pictures in a few minutes, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
We got to see if we can get rid of that.